Thanks, Ted. It's really nice to, I mean, you're supposed to say it's really nice to be, but it really is really nice to be back. It feels like a homecoming. Lots of, you know, familiar faces, and actually had the chance to walk back to the home that we owned when I was a PhD student on Kendall Avenue, and that was kind of, it was an out-of-body experience. So it's like, but they repainted it, how dare they, some 16 years later. Today, what I want to talk about is I want to provide a framework for thinking about information management under authoritarianism through the example of Central Asia. Hopefully, it will be a framework that might travel beyond Central Asia, but of course, it comes from this particular area of expertise. I want to start with Uzbekistan. In late 2014, the popular Uznews.net, the last remaining semblance of independent journalism in Uzbekistan, closed its doors. In 2015, Freedom House gave Uzbekistan, this is going to surprise absolutely nobody, a 95 out of 100 for press freedom, 100 being the worst in terms of press freedom. Such rankings and evaluations, of course, are deeply flawed, and there's a great book that's just come out by Alex Cooley and Jack Snyder, basically dealing with these kinds of world rankings and how problematic they are. But nonetheless, they give us a rough cut. There's no doubt that Uzbekistan is among the worst places to be a journalist. As a result, Uzbekistan is often depicted, and rightly so, as being marked by repression, paranoia, and propaganda. And these are just a couple of words that come from recent press coverage, Al Jazeera, New York Times, Financial Times. It deserves these kinds of depictions. But what I want to look into is what it means, actually, to live in such information environments. So let's start with somebody we'll call Rustam. From Uzbekistan's Fergana Valley, a small business owner whom I dropped in on for a visit in the summer of 2006. And this was about a year after the massacre in the city of Andijan, in which government troops fired on crowds, killing, by official count, 183 people. But human rights groups suggest it's probably upwards of 800 or more. In the intervening year from 2005 to 2006, the Karimov of regime tightened control over all journalists, foreign and domestic. Yet Rustam, a moderately devout Muslim, and I sat for hours watching a wide range of channels on his satellite TV together and having an equally wide-ranging discussion about world affairs. We talked about World Cup soccer, which was on at the time a favorite topic for many people in the region, about the American role in Afghanistan, also something of broad interest, and about the Baptist preachers whose sermons graced Rustam's airwaves. And he happened to believe that Uzbekistan had become so deeply immoral in the post-Soviet period that any attempt to bring religious principles to the life of Uzbeks was most welcome. Now, we often envision opposites about life under repression, paranoia, and propaganda. On the one hand, we contend that, I don't know if you guys can see that, that propaganda produces disempowered subjects. The absence of private, independent media deprives individuals of the information that's necessary for them to live free and full lives. The information that is available to them, it comes to be viewed by definition as propaganda, and the individuals living under such authoritarian rule are viewed by definition as victims. On the other hand, we have a slightly different narrative in which individuals living under such circumstances become heroes. This is most familiar in the depictions of people like Timur Kuran, who talks about the falsification of public preferences, about how people harbor private inner truths that are unshakable. And as a corollary in this sort of depiction, the regimes that provide propaganda are by definition illegitimate and seek, whenever possible, to tighten the noose on a public that is poised otherwise for rebellion. Question mark. There are different depictions, and what's life really like under these kinds of conditions? Rustam was not tight-lipped. He was not, at least as far as I could tell, afraid. And at least in the conversations with me, Rustam was not particularly behaving as if. This is a phrase that Lisa Wadeen has used to describe life in authoritarian Syria, as if he supported the Karimov regime. Rustam was a discerning viewer of the channels that were on that long and pleasant evening. Now, the argument I want to make today is that today's authoritarian regimes use propaganda, but it's not your grandfather's propaganda. It's not their grandparents, about propaganda, I should probably say. Likewise, the individuals living under today's authoritarian rule are citizen subjects unlike their grandparents. Their agency is different from what we saw under Soviet rule, and that's what I want to probe a bit today. This has very much to do, I want to suggest, with the very different information environments that Central Asians find themselves in today. And so I'll offer this broad characterization. This is sort of background assumptions. If you have any questions about how I come to them, we can talk about them in the Q&A, but I think they'll be somewhat familiar. I'll suggest that today's information environments are quite porous, and this goes for Central Asia, it goes for authoritarian contexts, in ways that we wouldn't have seen 30 years ago, and this has to do with the familiar story of the great difficulty of containing the flow of information, the ease with which it's transmitted, and so on. Fairly porous information environments, even under authoritarianism. Linked to that, information is prone to cascading. So we will see the mechanisms of dissemination are so varied and so hard to keep tabs of, even under these kinds of conditions of authoritarianism, that while most information most of the time goes unnoticed, because, and rightly so, most of it's trivial, right? Most of the things that are sort of traded between people, any communication has the potential at any moment to, as they say, go viral. So this is also probably fairly familiar. Third thing, and there's a question mark at the end there, is that we may be in a situation where, at least in the Central Asian context, where it's not clear what exactly the hegemony, if there is an ideology in any of these kinds of contexts, and we'll get into that in a second, it's not clear if that ideology has the kind of hegemonic stability that it would have had in bygone eras, it's called, let's talk about the Soviet era. In other words, we may be in a moment where the degree to which people know how to self-censor, this could be changing, is much less than we would have seen in the past. You know, I'll leave that for the moment because this is just sort of background to sort of to the story that I want to get into. So in such environments, old school propaganda becomes much costlier. The North Koreas, the Turkmenistans, and the Eritreas of the world are exceptional. More typical are Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Kazakhstan, in which regimes calculate that the costs of seeking total control are much higher than the benefits that such control might be understood to bring. And so this is where we get to a term that I want to sort of offer here, which is information management. There's active efforts on the part of these regimes to control to manage rather than to control flows of information. And I'll get into some of the specifics in a second, but to use this term is to signal a shift in what I see as the nature of that political dynamic. So my wife was very happy that I got that icon in there. So this is the IM, information management three-step. You see that? Okay, she was very happy. So I'm glad the PowerPoint works, if only so that I can show that. Okay, so the information management three-step. I want to suggest that there are three dimensions to information management. This is the framework that I want to try and emphasize today. It involves several different steps, and these are interrelated. They're not mutually exclusive. They are things that we can talk about how they interrelate later. Reputational steps, positional steps, and communicative steps, and let me go through them one at a time. Start with reputational steps, tactics taken by the regime to build their reputation. These are things that are designed generally over the for long-term effect. They involve things like creating textbooks, designing curricula, all the kinds of things that sociologists talk about to socialize and re-socialize citizens into particular narratives about state and society, about state and nation. And these kinds of things are broadcast rather than narrowcast. And I'll get to that distinction later on. They're broadcast to broad publics domestically, but also internationally. And I think in the case of many of the Central Asian regimes, the international dimension is as important as the domestic one. The question is, you know, the reputation for what, right? So these are regimes that are trying to build a broad reputation. Reputation for what? So we could go back to Weber, we could talk about other forms of legitimation that one would seek. And these regimes will vary somewhat in terms of the kinds of strategies that they will deploy. Does legitimacy hinge upon making a claim to be the champion of tradition, on generating economic growth, on alleviating poverty, on providing security against internal and external foes. None of these are mutually exclusive, but by degree, we see different versions of this in each of the Central Asian contexts. There's a common thread, though, right, across Central Asia, and this, again, will be familiar to those who pay attention to the region. There are narratives about state and nation, narratives that in which the regime stands in for the state, and the state stands in for the nation, and so you have a complete conflation, this is the claim, right, of the interests of the regime and the interests of the broader public. So just a couple of examples really briefly, because this is not the... I'll just go through this briefly so we can get to the meat of the talk. But these are, you know, people writing on Central Asia talk about this all the time. In Uzbekistan, we have the cult of Timur, in which Timur's leadership qualities were understood to be reincarnated with Islam Karimov. Magically, how this happens, we don't know. But the claim is pretty clear about what it means to be a good leader is exactly the qualities that Karimov possesses, and this was clear. We'll see what happens with this next over the next decade or longer. Also in Uzbekistan, we have reputation building around a notion of manaviyat, and Sarah Kendzior actually writes really interestingly about this, about the morality that Islam Karimov would claim is characteristic of Uzbek society. A certain kind of morality, not particularly religiously based, but a morality about care for others, a morality about social justice, which was understood to be the rationale, was trotted out as the rationale for certain kinds of redistributive, and not to mention politically repressive kinds of policies of the Uzbek government. So there's a broad narrative being trotted out. Laura Adams talks about this as well when she gets into the spectacular state in which Uzbekistan, through a series of, through pageantry, basically conflates the interests of the regime and the interests of the nation. In Tajikistan, we get this as well with the celebration of so-called Aryan culture and its autochthony. Right, to show just how ancient the Tajik peoples are. In fact, they're equally ancient, if not more ancient, than the Uzbeks. A very important sort of competition over ancestors going on in not only in this part of the world, but elsewhere. But also in Tajikistan, we see a reputation, sort of a spinning of a narrative in which Rahmon, President Rahmon, is depicted as the person who single-handedly ended the civil war in Tajikistan. Whether or not this is factually correct is a separate question. And therefore, as the sole guarantor of stability in this entire region. Again, this is sort of a broad narrative being trotted out. In Kazakhstan, slightly different, although we do see appeal to tradition and to a notion that Nazarbayev is uniquely able to tap into Kazakh traditions. It's weaker on that particular dimension. And the narratives that are trotted out there are about Kazakhstan as a particularly effective bridge between East and West, between Islam and Christianity, and so on and so forth. But also a narrative about Kazakhstan is particularly well placed to prosper, to embrace modernity, to become a good citizen in the international sphere, and so on. So everything that Nazarbayev University, I'll get to Nazarbayev University in a second. Okay. That's the broad reputational sorts of strategies. There are positional strategies as well. On the fence of whether these are strategies or tactics, we'll get to that in a second. Positional tactics. These are moves to enable the regime to be in a position to deliver regime favorable messages. In other words, you want to be in a position to be able to communicate to the broad public. But these are the steps that come to enable that to happen in the first place. Let me just give you a sense of what this means. Those who study former Soviet space will know all that administrative resources. This is the sort of catchphrase meant to characterize the peculiar access that regimes have to all the resources of the state, where the informal meets the formal, right? So that you can avail yourself, whether it's legal or not, of everything that the state has to offer if you are the incumbent regime. And by doing so, you can do a whole series of things, whether it's legal or not is really not what I'm looking at here. You can stack the judiciary. Stacking sounds actually pretty benign. What you end up doing, of course, is you generate an entirely compliant judicial system, which can engineer the kinds of favorable legal outcomes that you desire, the pressure on anybody who needs to be pressured, and so on and so forth. Favorable libel laws allow you to do that with the private sector as well. So if there are private actors who need to be reined in or whose loyalty needs to be reestablished, then libel laws can allow you to do that. I'm not sure. I'm going to point to Kathy. Tell me if I'm wrong. But it seems like a clear pattern in Russia, but certainly and probably to a greater extent in Central Asia. Selective harassment. And this is selectively, typically it's selective. Uzbekistan is at the further end of this, a little bit more indiscriminate. But in other places, selectively jailing intransigent journalists, bloggers, and increasingly Facebook posters. So be careful. And the result of all of this is to create what Levitsky and Way called an unlevel playing field, fairly intuitive, whereby certain kinds of positions are inherently vulnerable to adopt, whereas other kinds of positions are safe and demonstrate your loyalty. Related to this is what Keith Darden talks about as the blackmail state. So the regime will continually collect compromising material on people so that they have something to hang over your head in case you show some kind of penchant for disloyalty. And just the fact that it's there can help to guarantee that kind of loyalty. So these are all positional steps in the sense that it creates the conditions for you to effectively communicate your regime favorable messages down the road. But this happens over the medium term. These are the kinds of things that typically are slower moving than the things that I'll talk about in just a second. Let me just mention very briefly that most of these are sort of what's called the material. People are being jailed, people are being shut down, people are being blackmailed. But there is a discursive dimension to this as well. So Bill Riker talked about the herostatics of power, in which you, for example, create events for the media to cover. So that there's an important discursive dimension that I won't have a chance to go into here. Okay, what I want to focus on is the communicative steps. And this is the more narrow cast kinds of efforts on the part of the regime to deliver specific messages to specific mini publics at any given moment. Where am I? Okay. How do these regimes attempt to get specific messages across to the public? And here what we're going to want to do is we're going to want to disaggregate the regime, because it should be obvious by now, but it bears repeating, that authoritarian regimes are complex entities. There are lots of moving parts. Ted and I were talking earlier about the Tajikistan case, about how the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing, and the two fingers on the same hand don't know what they're doing. There are a lot of moving parts. At a minimum, there's a lack of coordination, there's competition, there are all sorts of things going on. So we're going to want to disaggregate the regime and its communicative efforts. So where the communication is coming from, what exactly is being said, says a lot about, or gives us interesting food for thought in thinking about what kinds of communications are effective and what are not. So we'll go through some of these. I'll just mention these at the outset. You'll see them when I get to the sort of empirical part. Communication obviously varies by the source. If a communication is coming from the ruling party, versus coming from the president, versus coming from your local Akim, versus coming from your local Aksakal, this may make a difference in terms of how it's received. Because basically, we know this from advanced industrial contexts, and I'll suggest that we're going to need to adjust when we apply these kinds of theories to autocracies, but we know that the credibility of the source matters in terms of who the messenger is makes a difference in terms of how that message is received. The topic varies. Obviously, communication will vary by topic. What the regime intends to communicate to people at any given moment is going to vary, and whether it's something about terrorism or something about the economy or something about the nefarious Western conspiracy, or the Great West. That hasn't happened in a while, but nonetheless, the topic will vary, and there's reason to suspect and to expect that people will react differently to different kinds of topics. They may have deeply held beliefs that are unshakable on certain topics, and on other topics they may be persuadable. The specificity of communication will vary. In other words, it's one thing to claim that, to say something very specific about the number of jobs that have been created in your particular region in this past month, and it's another thing to say, you know, our economy is booming in some macro sense without any specifics. And these communications are not necessarily one is more effective than the other, they're just different degrees of specificity. The links to the overall regime narrative will vary. So in some cases, we'll see people invoking the larger project of the nation in their more micro communications. In other cases, they don't. And the tone can vary. And I'll get into a particular example of that, which I find interesting. But sometimes communications are presented as simply informational. For your information, there is this fact. Other times they are, for example, we'll get to an example, explicitly and quite obviously confronting the fact of the Western conspiracy to encircle us. And so the tone of these communications will vary quite a bit. Okay, so let me just put these all... All right, last point on this. One of the things that, if we consider the variation of communications, and we consider that people may respond to some things, people may be persuaded by some communications and not by others, I want to suggest that we return some agency to the citizen subjects who live under authoritarian rule. And that would be a take home here. I want to suggest that people living under authoritarianism should be treated with you know, as independent agents who can discern you know, what might be we're thinking people with some degree of agency, if of course constrained by authoritarian conditions. So here's the summary. The reputational positional, probably hard to see. The time horizons are different. The reputational is long. Positional is generally more medium. Communicative is short term. The audience is going to be different. Reputational, the broad public. The positional one is they're really targeting those who supply information, right? The information providers, the journalists, bloggers, and so on. The communicative one tends to target more mini publics. We'll get into that in a bit. And there's of course coercion underlying all of these forms of communication. These are authoritarian contexts. Let's not forget this is not an innocent provision of information. There is, at least in the background, coercion, but sometimes it's more explicit and sometimes it's less explicit in the positional ones where they're jailing bloggers. Obviously that's quite coercive, the series of moves on the part of the regime. The communication, the narrowcast communication that I talked about, doesn't, by itself at least, link up to, obviously, to coercion, though, again, like I said, it's always in the background. Okay. So how do we go about this? Here's what I want to do. I want to focus on these communicative strategies because I think that they are they're not studied at least in the context of authoritarianism. I think they should be studied because I think that they give some degree of agency, the kind of agency that people they deserve to be treated with in even though they live under authoritarian conditions. I also think that we make the assumption, wrongly so, that everything flows from coercion. That simply because there's this overwhelming power on the part of these authoritarian regimes, they must necessarily get their message through. And I want to suggest that that's not always the case, or sometimes it is, and sometimes it's not. How do we go about this? Well, I turn to literature that some of you will be familiar with. That comes from political psychology and from social movements on frames and framing. And framing is basically a process by which choices are made about how to present information, about how to present reality. And the idea is that if you highlight certain dimensions of reality, you make them more salient to the person you're presenting them to, and therefore you provide them with a series of considerations that are different from considerations that were not provided. Okay? You may not be convincing them, you may not be changing their core beliefs, but you're shifting how they're perceiving a certain set of issues. And the idea is that this may be consequential, and allow people to interpret their reality in at least a slightly different way than they would have otherwise. So people who focus on framing will ask a series of questions. And again, in the context of advanced industrial societies, where a lot of this literature comes from, the answers are getting to be fairly clear. Are people susceptible to framing effects? That is, if you present information a particular way, do they have an effect? And the answer is, often enough, yes, right? But it depends, and it depends on a whole series of things that people, that I won't get into here, but we'll get into in the context of Kazakhstan and Tajikistan in a second. Do people react differently to frames depending on the topic? Again, are there issue areas in which people have deeply held beliefs that are simply unshakable, whereas other things they may be more more susceptible to shifting how they respond? And do people react differently to frames depending on the source of information? Here, I mean, again, in the context of advanced industrial societies, the answer is clearly yes, and I want to ask if that's the same thing for authoritarian contexts. Okay, so what we did is something that anyone who has any idea of the kind of research I typically do will say, are you sure you did this kind of research? Because this is not typical of the kind of stuff that I do. But I did a survey in Kazakhstan and Tajikistan. I commissioned a survey, let's be honest. I commissioned a survey through a public opinion poll, a polling agency in Astana. And they ran, this is a nationwide, stratified randomized sample designed to be nationally representative. We'll talk about that if anybody's interested. 1,500 people in each of Kazakhstan and Tajikistan. It's basically what we tried to do is do survey experimental questions. Okay, so there's a whole series of survey experimental questions embedded in here, and it's principally about these survey experiments. And the good thing about survey experiments, we'll get into this in a second, is we know that in authoritarian contexts, it's hard to know how to interpret people's answers to public opinion polls, right? It's really hard to know if someone holds up a microphone and says, do you like Putin or not? It's hard to know how to interpret their answer or non-answer, okay? But in this context, what you do is you essentially subdivide the responses and you compare them to each other. So if there's a systematic, say, bias in people saying, I really love Putin, you can compare people who've received different framing treatments, and you're able to say something presumably about the effect of those kinds of frames. So, in other words, I think you can do this kind of thing in authoritarian regimes. It's challenging. We could talk about the practicalities there, but nonetheless, I think it gives us some interesting food for thought. So let me give an example of a survey experiment question that we used, and there are a whole series of these. I'll get into a few of the concrete examples. These are identical texts. I'll just read it because I realize it's a little small here. Identical texts, they both say, the very expression religious extremism is at root inaccurate. Not a single religion in the world justifies violence and even less calls for it. Any religion is essentially peace-loving and morally sound, teaching people justice, kindness, and empathy. Okay, and the second one says exactly the same thing. So these are identical. And what we did was we varied the attribution of this quotation. So there are different attributions. In the first case, it's the chair of the Agency on Religious Affairs who said it. So a government, somebody who's people's minds are affiliated with the government. In the second case, an ostensibly non-political attribution. So this is a film a fictional film that we called In Search of the Spiritual Path, shot by contract of Kazakh Film. Okay, which is nominally independent film studio in Kazakhstan. So that's the attribution. And there's a control group that got nothing. Okay, so they received absolutely no additional information. And then we asked a question, basically, what do you think about religion? So the frame, let me go back. The frame basically says, you know, religious extremism is nonsense. Religion is good. It's a force for good in the world, right? And so then the question says, which of the following is most accurate? Religion always has a positive effect. Religion often has a positive impact. Religion often creates problems. Religion always creates problems. So it's a simple sort of scale. And you see whether the frame shifts people's on average responses to these questions. And that's the basic principle of this. Yeah.
Clarifying question. So in the control condition, then who do respondents think is making this statement?
There's no statement at all.
No, oh, no statement
yeah.
at all.
Yeah. So statement, whenever
that's we... Just no front.
Yeah, you can't control everything. So yeah, so, I mean, if you have too many treatments, then it's hard to interpret. So, yeah, so one other way to do it would be to provide a statement but have no attribution. That's challenging because then in people's minds, they're attributing it to the people administering the survey. Right. So we decided to go with absolutely no statement whatsoever as the control. And then you compare the on average responses. Okay, so you probably want to know what we found. So let's get to some of this stuff. And a lot of this is, you know, I look forward to what you have to say about it, especially the methodologist, but not only, because I want to hear how this resonates with people's own understandings of authoritarian contexts, specifically Central Asian ones, or whether it just sort of makes logical sense to you. The first thing we found is that, yes, topic matters quite a bit. Let me just get specific here. Our questions in the economy, and there are a series of questions that were related to the economy, a series of treatments about the economy and about the effective state management of the economy. And they had little or no impact on how people responded. In other words, positive depictions of how the state, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, is managing the economy did not shift anybody's understanding, the on-average responses, compared to the control group that got no depiction at all. Right? So if you thought the economy was terrible, then there was nothing that could be said that really changed that fact. That's on average. Little to no impact. In Tajikistan, there's a little bit for one of the questions. And here it's important to recognize very different contexts, and that this was conducted in 2014. Kazakhstan, you see a slowing growth in 2014. And there's a strong narrative in Kazakhstan, as I mentioned at the beginning, about prosperity and about how our wise economic policies, which perhaps they've been wise, I don't know, but there's certainly the claim to legitimacy has hinged upon that. And it's hard in that kind of context to ignore the fact that the economy is slowing down. In Tajikistan, they're also slow down in growth, but not to the same extent. Doesn't rise and fall with commodity prices in the same way as Kazakhstan did. And the narrative undergirding sort of the reputation of the regime was never really particularly about the economy in the first place. It was more about stability and avoiding a return to civil war. So, in general, though, people don't seem to budge if they're presented with communications about the economy. Terrorism. When presented with positive depictions of the state, of the ability of the state to fight terrorism, you see a variable impact. And it's kind of interesting. In Kazakhstan, things move in the exact opposite of what you predict. In other words, if I present you with a positive depiction of the state's ability to fight terrorism, in Kazakhstan, people look at that and they say, you're trying to pull one over on me. In fact, I am even more scared of terrorism because you just mentioned that, right? Compared to control. So in other words, if they had no depiction at all, and again, context here matters, because Kazakhstan had really never experienced actual terrorist attacks. There are all sorts of conspiracy theories one could talk about in terms of which ones of the incidents were, you know, actual terrorist attacks and so on. But nonetheless, there were real terrorist attacks in Kazakhstan that were starting to become more frequent. And so this would have been a concern in that particular context. But it's interesting that particular timing, there's almost nothing that you could say if you were the regime trying to placate people, at least over the short term, they wouldn't believe you. In Tajikistan, there was either no impact or positive impact, and we did it different ways. So let me get to the different ways in a second. So again, if you provide people with information that the Tajik regime is doing a good job fighting terrorism, so here's the frame. The state is effective in combating terrorism. I'm summarizing a very long kind of actual text that people got. If you attribute that to one source, if you attribute it to the official news agency, Khabar, then there's a little bit of an effect. I'll get to that in a second. What we did is we attributed it to one source, or we attributed it to three different sources. We broke that long paragraph into three different statements. The first statement being from Havar, second one from TVT, and the third one from a fictional state report on terrorism, on anti-terrorism. In other words, three different official accounts, but the same text, right? In the first case, there was no effect. And in the second, case, there is a strong and statistically significant effect. And it's hard to know exactly what to make of this, but it's highly significant. Yeah. You don't want to, yeah.
Are the three in the one passage, or are there three different?
No, there's three different passages, but it's the same. So take the paragraph.
So
you break it into
you've
three.
Got four different things plus a control as your.
No. No. This is one treatment. So people are so you would get read these three things.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Three poundings.
What's it called?
Three poundings,
yeah. So there's something, I mean, so it's hard, you don't want to overinterpret these kinds of things, but there's something about the reiteration from supposedly different sources, even though they're all official sources, that lends greater plausibility to, right? It suggests that there's a consensus or something like that. Anyway, there are a series of suggestive conclusions that one could come to. On that point.
Why didn't you repeat that in Kazakhstan?
No, we did. But only in Tajikistan is this does it work out this way.
The same thing was done in Kazakhstan.
Everything is done in both countries. Okay. So, but in Kazakhstan, anytime you mention terrorism, people get scared, even if you're telling how wonderful a job we're doing fighting terrorism. In Tajikistan, if you say we're doing a good job fighting terrorism, there's either no effect if you hear it from one source, or there is an effect if you hear it from three sources. I'm not exactly sure what to do with that. That's why you're here to tell me. But that's empirically what's going on. Sources matter, right? So, and the messenger matters. It matters who is offering the depiction. Let me give the example of Nazarbayev University. This was we did a par- there's no Nazarbayev University in Tajikistan. So, to your point about the parallel analysis. We used the then tallest flagpole in the world. I don't know if anybody knows about this in Tajikistan, the source of some pride in Tajikistan. Not quite on the scale of Nazarbayev University, but there really wasn't an alternative. Okay, we could have used the Roman Dam or something like that. But anyway, we did Nazarbayev University. So, and what we found here is, what we did is we gave people a depiction about Nazarbayev University as a world-class university, which, thanks to John Lee, it is. That is doing good for the country of Kazakhstan. Okay, so that was the depiction that was given, and we attributed that to, this is back to Scott's question, we can't control everything simultaneously, right? So we, in this case, attributed that to the ruling party, so it was a Nur-Otan statement, or we gave people we didn't give people this depiction, this frame at all, right? So they were just asked a question about Nazarbayev University. And this is just an example of a really strong effect in the opposite direction, right? So Kazakhs, in particular, take with a huge grain of salt the communications that they receive. When they're told by Nur-Otan that Nazarbayev University is world class and doing good for Kazakhstan, they say, it must not be. It must not be. And so the on average response actually declines. Okay? I don't know exactly what to make of that, but I think it has something to do with, if the president said it, that might be one thing. There are other parts of the survey where it's clear that the president is, if the president is the source, then that communication is not discounted, but the ruling party, Nur-Otan, at least in this case, is, yeah.
So just on this particular question, how do you handle people who've never heard of Nazarbayev? Because in the treatment, you're telling them, there is this thing called Nazarbayev University, and someone in the government, the government is saying it's good, but the other is, what are you hearing about blah, 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 blah? To some of them, it's incomprehensible. Presumably, not everyone in Kazakhstan has heard of Nazarbayev University.
How can that possibly be true? Okay, all right, that's honestly something I hadn't thought of. I mean, it is pretty widely known across Kazakhstan, at least as a matter of some symbolism.
It's not a problem, right? Anyway. It's randomly assigned. Randomization takes care of that. You assume that the random ignorance is on both sides, right?
But it's a coding issue. So how do you code so presumably in the group C, the treatment group, some of the people would say, I don't know. And so how do you code those in estimating your mean scores for your...
So people who receive no information about it are just going to be rolling a die,
so
right?
Let him finish first, and then
we'll... No, it's okay.
Did you force a response, or could they say, don't know?
There is a don't know. There's a don't know. But I haven't looked. That's a good question. I mean, you would expect more don't knows. And so I'll have to look at that. I don't know the answer to that question. Nonetheless, if you take it at face value, it does seem like there's some, you know, people are pretty discerning. They're trying to make this, they're trying to interpret information based on the credibility that they accord to the source. I can't remember if I have more on this example. No, I don't. Okay. Another example. Well, actually, the example I gave at the beginning, where we had this fictional film on the spiritual path or something. I can't remember what we called it. When it's attributed to Kazakh film, it actually is quite effective. When it's attributed to the official agency on religious affairs, it has no effect in the predicted direction. And so there's something here about people responding well to sources they perceive to be non-political, not having an agenda. Now, whether Kazakh film has a political agenda or not is an empirical question. But people have coded it as non-political, I would interpret it, and therefore respond accordingly. But not so in Tajikistan. I don't know much about Tajik film. It doesn't quite have the same cachet as Kazakh film, which has really, you know, become quite significant across Tajik films in international competitions, and they've become quite productive and well supported. Tajik film doesn't have that kind of impact. Okay, one last example, because I realize we're sort of
we started late.
Okay, all right, we're fine. All right, but I do want to have time for questions and comments. One of the things that we can't particularly do well in the context of a survey experiment, there are limits to any methodology, but in this particular case, it's difficult to reconstruct the actual way that people in real world situations process information, right? Because this is highly contrived. We've asked them to respond to particular kinds of frames. In the real world, if you present me with a frame, there usually is a competing frame coming from somewhere else, and I have to adjudicate among many different ones in order to make arrive at my own understanding of a particular issue. You can't really get at that very well. There's one question that we had that attempts to go in that direction, and it has to do empirically with the reactions to Western criticisms of elections. And this is fairly predictable in authoritarian Central Asia. Kyrgyzstan, again, slight exception on this score. Parliamentary elections, presidential elections, whatever elections are held, the Western observers typically, and with justification, call out these regimes for having conducted unfree and unfair elections because they failed to meet international standards. So elections, parliamentary elections are held in Kazakhstan and in Tajikistan. And what we did is we offered, there's a control as well, but we offered two different frames. We'll call them the soft counter-narrative and the hard counter-narrative. We'll run with that. OSCE will criticize elections. OSCE standing in for the West in this particular case. The OSCE offers its criticism of elections. In the soft version, people are presented with the OSCE criticism, a couple of lines, and then followed by the endorsement of the elections as meeting international standards by the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. So in other words, it's sort of, OSCE thinks that that elections were unfair, and the SCO thinks that they're fair, okay? And the idea is to see how people react, what people think about Western criticism after being presented with this bit of information, we'll call it. In the harder version, they receive the OSCE criticism, and then they get a scathing SCO rebuttal. Not just these elections met international standards, but the OSCE is part of a Western agenda to destabilize the region so that the United States can take over your oil. Okay? So in other words, it's indexing a conspiracy theory, which is as far-fetched as it may sound to probably most of you in the room. It's something that has some legs in this part of the world. Okay, but the idea is to sort of see which kind of approach would be more effective or effective at all in shifting how people respond to questions about the whether Western criticism of elections were justified. And I actually thought that the softer version would be more effective. There is a little bit of an effect that the sort of measured diluting of the pool. It's your opinion that the elections were unfair. It's our opinion that they were fair. I thought that this would be an effective way to counter Western criticism. And we see this all the time empirically in Central Asia. I haven't followed this in the last couple of years, but certainly throughout the elections I have been watching closely, what they'll do is they'll bring SEO observers on to, you know, give their commentary about it, sort of dilute the criticism by saying, well, the OSCE had this to say, and the SEO had this to say, and then they'll have Russian experts come in and get on the airwaves and talk about how actually it did meet international standards, it's actually better than Florida in 2000 and all of that kind of stuff, right? So I thought that would be more effective, and it turns out that the second one, at least in this particular context, in 2014, was much more effective. And I'm not sure exactly what to make of that, but I'll try something on for size in a second. It does seem that in porous information environments in which the regime faces strong messaging from another source, an aggressive counter-message is more effective than a softer one. Yeah?
Do you give any information about the OSCE?
Right. So this is kind of Ted's question as well. I mean, I think the way to deal with that is to go to the don't knows in the control group and see if it's significantly higher, right?
Because you just say the name. You don't give
you just say the name. Though you it is clear from the text. I don't have it on the screen, but it is clear from the text that this is an organization from the outside critiquing our elections. And where would that come from? Not China, right? So I think that people can kind of deduce it, but I think you're right. Going to the don't knows, can't answer would help to address that. Okay. I want to zoom out, but before I zoom out and sort of talk about the broader significance and realizing that there's a lot of interpretation here that is that we should be careful about. There's a lot here in, I mean, anyone who's done this kind of work will know that responses are very sensitive to wording, to things that are hard to control for. So some of the things that Scott was mentioning, you can't control for everything. And even the fact that we had a series of survey experimental questions in this makes the effect harder to discern with certainty. And there's another sort of caveat here, and that is that, you know, in real world situations, if communication comes to a member of a public living under authoritarianism, they may be persuaded in the short term, and that may wash out in the longer term. And there are people like Diana Mutz, who used to be here at UW-Madison, who's done interesting work on how discussion afterwards actually tends to wash out some of these framing effects. In other words, people may be temporarily persuaded, but then once they go back to their kitchens and to their villages and to their apartment buildings and they have conversations on these issues, then the effect seems to diminish. And so she's done some interesting work over time. But I would suggest that this does give us good places to look and very good reasons to reconsider how we think authoritarianism works. So let me give a couple things by way of kind of unsettled conclusion. I want to suggest that communication does not flow seamlessly from other strategies of authoritarian rule, let alone from the overwhelming coercive capabilities of the state and regime. It's hardly a done deal that a regime can communicate its preferred message and get that message home. Now, whether a regime actually makes the choices that we've built into the survey experiment is hard to get it, right? I mean, it's hard to know whether the regime is thinking, we're going to use a scathing approach, right? We're going to use a hard approach rather than a soft. I mean, that's an empirical question that's really hard to get at. I tried to couple this with something that's more familiar to me, sort of ethnographic approach, and I was working with the ruling party in Kazakhstan, Nur Otan, and was all set up to do some more observation than participation, but, you know, participant observation in the context of the party schools of Nur Otan to try to get closer to this. And things seemed set up, and then my access was just suddenly curtailed and without explanation. There were some personnel changes, and they no longer wanted the foreign researcher in their midst. So these are, you know, empirical questions that one would like to get at empirically, but sometimes we can't get exactly the perfect access that we want. But all of the frames that we used were culled from actual public statements by actual public figures in Kazakhstan and Tajikistan. So we tried to use ones that were plausible, even if they weren't actually used. Remind me later. Okay. All right. Okay. One of the key findings is that for communications to be effective, a lot of this suggests that the regime has to have, you know, call this the manual for autocrats today, instruction manual for autocrats. They need to have good contextual knowledge of the audience that they're connecting with and attempting to persuade or communicate with, and how the audience might view the relative credibility of one source versus another. I don't particularly want this to go back to Kazakhstan so that they can now route everything through Kazakh film because they know that that's going to have some kind of an impact. But that's the kind of implication, is that the regime must be in the business to sustain itself as a relative on the softer end of the authoritarian scale. It must gather information about its audience and its the audience expectations. Now, this can be done through surveillance, and these states or particular regimes are particularly good at surveillance. But not only. A smart authoritarian regime, if it's interested in avoiding the sort of naked use of coercion, should provide space for individuals to participate and or voice their perspectives, because not to do so is to foreclose access to information that might be of signal value to the regime and its survival. So here, you know, you get to, you know, people in the room know Russia much better than I do, but I think about Russia's troll factories, right, where Russia keeps these spaces open so that people can comment, but if it needs to, it can try to tilt the playing field and say, you know, the comments on some kind of blog by deploying its army of trolls so that they can, you know, monopolize the conversation, reestablish the hegemonic narrative, but without foreclosing access to those dissenting voices, because you want to know what those people are saying. That's the point. Talk about agency under authoritarianism. I mean, you know, people living under authoritarian rule are not necessarily victims, not necessarily heroes. Might be either one of those. There are those people around. But we want a framework that gives people agency. This is important for normative reasons. We want to treat people as something more than dupes, but without judging them for not rising up to meet our liberal expectations about the intolerability of authoritarian rule. It's also important, I think, for analytic reasons. It's impossible to understand the dynamic of change, and these places do change, sometimes in significant ways, sometimes in sort of slower moving ways, but there's a lot of ferment and change going on under authoritarianism. But if we can't appreciate that without understanding the vast middle ground. Again, there's no shortage of genuine victims, there's no shortage of genuine heroes, but most people are simply getting along, and I think we should pay attention to them and not limit our gaze to the polar extremes. Political psychology and its value. Here, I just want to suggest that there's value in sort of tapping that vast field of political psychology that is so well developed, but so focused on advanced industrial. We've learned a lot about advanced industrial context. It's easier to do this kind of work in advanced industrial context. It should continue to be done in those kinds of contexts, but it should be adapted and used for the study of autocracies. The conditions here are different. There are deep asymmetries of access to information that need to be taken into account when we think about how this all works. There's a sense in which information can contain different kinds of valences than it might under sort of more liberal kinds of politically liberal kinds of contexts. Information could be liberating, and that's the narrative we tend to offer. But information and access to information can also, under autocracy, can produce vulnerabilities. It can introduce risks that given the coercive nature of these kinds of regimes. So we shouldn't assume that access to information is always something that people necessarily would desire. It's tricky for philosophical normative terrain, but nonetheless, we have to understand that information can potentially play a different kind of role in the in these kinds of contexts. Okay. And I think we should seriously think about how political psychology works in a new information, in new information environment that characterizes today. This is hard stuff. People in communications departments study this all the time. I think it's hard to get a really good handle on. But it's an environment in which information overload is as much the issue as information scarcity. Information scarcity is what we assume is at play under authoritarianism, but I want to suggest that even there, that's really not what's going on. There's a different kind of dynamic than we might assume, and that might have been the case in sort of autocracies of bygone eras. And so people find themselves in a maelstrom of hard facts, rumor, ambiguity, of innuendo, emotional appeal, logical appeal, obfuscation, and so on, all under tremendous constraints of time and processing capacity. People do not take information in and use it, though they might do that, so much as they stew in these information environments. So today's autocrats in Central Asia, and probably elsewhere, know this. And apropos of nothing at all, but somehow the word autocrat got me thinking about this, I was reading Adam Gopnik has a nice little piece in the online version of the New Yorker about reacting to Trump in the debate the other day, and he describes what he calls Trump's ramblings with their telegraphic simplifications, their abrupt disconnects, and their sudden hallucinations of imaginary figures, which I think is great. And whether or not it's an accurate depiction of Trump, it sort of begins to capture the information environment in this sense. One way to think of Trump's style is to consider it to be a product of the information environment in which we all stew. In other words, it's confusing. It's far more confusing than we tend to assume. We choose many heuristics and simplifications in order to cut through the mess. Sometimes the noisiest of messages are the ones that actually cut through. It remains to be seen if stewing in this kind of information environment in a democratic context is ultimately different from stewing in an autocratic one. Thanks very much for sticking around. And
we have time for questions, comments.
For Donald Trump, all the questions were asked during the lecture yesterday when people interrupted.
I'm sorry, I had to step outside. Yes. Somebody was leaving for work.
Yes. What was the religion question the result? That was fascinating.
The religion question.
The religion experimental effect.
Yeah. Okay.
The first slide you had, it gave us an example of experiment. Did you show that result?
I only mentioned it. I mentioned it. So the example of Kazakh, where we.
Is really
right.
A message laden kind of thing as far as I can tell.
Right. So here, again, this is back to the great challenge. You can't control for everything. You can only have so many treatments and so on in any given question. So what we did is this is the Kazakh film, right? So the religion is a force for good, was the frame. And in one case, it's a control where people didn't get the frame. And then in
Kazakh film, and then there was the authority.
The Kazakh film, and then the authority. And so in the case, so the authority has no effect. It doesn't have a negative effect. It has
really?
No effect. With Kazakh film, it has a significant and positive effect in the direction you would predict. And so my interpretation, again, you have to be, these are the kinds of things you'd want to follow up on, but we only have one question on that particular kind of issue. My interpretation is that my expectation, this was an explicit hypothesis on this one going in, which is that non-political sources are more likely to be treated a priori as credible than those that are coded as political or from the state.
Let me ask you one question. I mean, one of the things that struck me is that you had different, particularly in the earlier results, different results for Kazakhstan and Tajikistan. And you explained those by the different contexts in the countries at the time.
Yeah.
Now, that's, I'm sure you're correct, you know those countries very well. But that, of course, is a weakness of this whole method in terms of what we have. Because it's the old-fashioned thing, what's in the book, where external factors that are coming into experimental design, quasi-experimental design. and those external factors may be really overwhelming in your part of the world. That's that's what bothers me. Maybe it's not. Maybe they affect everything. We rarely think about those in survey experimental situations using American data.
Really?
The University of Michigan does not think about that problem. I've never heard it referred to as external stuff unless there's something so weird that's a result of those things. And it was interesting because, well, often we're not doing comparative stuff.
Yeah.
We're just doing the United States stuff, but we don't have a comparative frame. But it doesn't mean that there's not a lot of impact of what's going on in the world. I mean, you can imagine survey research after 9/11, for example, for how long? A year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years?
Yeah.
What do you get? Get a whole different world of attitudes and results and reactions, I would think. I mean, I'm not an expert in this area, Ted. You know. Anyway, I thought it was interesting.
Yeah, no,
probably
no, no,
correct, but also a weakness.
No. I mean, I guess I'm at a point in my career where I can kind of say I'm okay with context weighing fairly heavily on these kinds of things. I mean, I think that at some point. What I want to say is at a bit of a higher level of abstraction. I want to say that the topic matters, right? For example, it just so happens that the economy is a fairly deeply, you know, thoughts on the economy are fairly deeply held in this particular moment. Does that necessarily make it permanent? No, so it's not a permanent claim. It may be a claim that will have some kind of staying power. It's not simply that, you know, Kazakhstan was going into wasn't yet in recession, but it was, you know, growth was clearly slowing at that particular moment. Were you there then, or 2000?
I was there for the graduation during the period, and it was being felt.
Yeah, right.
The loss of it. And, you know, the problem with Kazakhstan, in one way, is state information on things like oil prices and the effect of an oil crisis and what the budget looks like is not known.
Yeah.
All you've got is innuendo, but, you know, when oil drops from 110 to 30, that's got to have an impact on it. On the economy of Kazakhstan.
I mean, there are things that this is the only method I sort of presented, the only sort of stuff I presented today, but of course it's consistent with other things we know about the region to say, to the extent that we see protests, for example, right, in the sort of post-color revolution kind of era, it's really along the lines of fairly everyday things, right? The condo building that was supposed to be built, and I put $20,000 down, and my money has now evaporated, right? The pensioners, right? So they're quite material things related to the economy, or job security. These kinds of things are quite real. Now, is that a permanent state of affairs? Is that contextual? I don't know. I mean, I don't think it's contextual in the sense that it's limited to 2014. So, but we'll see. Right?
Well, one of the things I haven't seen again in the American context using these things, and I'm intrigued by these experiments, so I look at them a lot.
Yeah.
I rarely see repetitions, and it would be there are some sequences that are repeated, but not. They're kind of expensive to do, so it's probably not. But the one that we can look at over time to see if context matters. In other words, you get this result this time, this result this time, this result, and you can you model that in relationship to a recession or a temp?
Right.
The one that we look at most is the trade-off between taxes and budget increase and budget deficit.
Okay.
That was the initial experimental thing. It's been done quite a bit by different things, and that would be an interesting research project for someone who's interested in looking at that. I think you could find 3 or 4 points in time. And I couldn't find any more, but you could find that.
John, I like doing this.
Oh, it's fun. It's fun.
But I really like field work. I really like I have sort of different kind of inclination. This is useful. This is useful, and I would like somebody to, you know, to sort of get back in and, you know, follow up or repeat, and I think it would be, I think
it's because of the vouchers and all the stuff there where they're claiming the gold standard for all these experimental things that are now going on in the policy world in America, and there are certain agencies and foundations that will not fund anything other than experimental design.
Yeah, that's probably
following up on those differences in the topics, and I feel like there is also like some insight here. Maybe not necessarily explain why it mattered, like in different countries, like Kazakhstan versus Tajikistan. But what I find here more is like comparing, like as you said, topics like economy versus terrorism. I feel like economy is something that people have experienced like through their daily lives, right? It's something that I can see in my paychecks, talking to people around me, knowing who's been laid off and who wasn't. And then terrorism is like something, like some entity out there, which, you know, regular people have very little experience. And if there are people, like, they know that there's like this secrecy behind it, so even if people work, they wouldn't tell about it in the kitchen, most likely. So I feel like maybe that also matters too, like, you know, it's just that topic matters. So maybe not all frames work different. If you have everyday experiences with the economy, something might not work. When it comes to terrorism, something is like out there that I don't have direct access to.
Most people have not experienced it directly, right?
Exactly. Okay. Then the frame kicks in because mm-hmm. this is everything that I have, which is this piece of information. Yeah. So I guess maybe that will help too, to kind of like, maybe like, kind of like, not the same methodology in terms of like, well, it's not because there's differences in economies, because economy is a different issue than terrorism.
Right, right. And different, not just because of different topics, but because people have direct experience with.
Yeah, like something that I experience in the everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, building on that, which I think is absolutely right, and that also makes the anti-Westernism a particularly useful subject for, you know, these governments and Russia to push, because, you know, people don't know what the American government is really planning to do, and why not believe that it's, you know, has all these plans to take over the oil, take over this, whereas things like the economy, religion, you know, even terrorism is a little more tangible in people's lives. So I think it's sort of an extreme issue area where the potential for framing is enhanced to the extent that people don't have a lot of direct experience. There's no other source of information they have other than these official kinds of media.
To extend the words, the problem is that information, whether positive or negative, has only very limited effect on the people's political views, behavior, etc. Any Russian who wants to find out the truth from any opportunity. Internet, radio liberty, and so on, and so on, and so on. The problem is either people don't care much or prefer to choose the information sources in accordance with their already shaped ideas, political views, etc. And that brings me to your lecture. If I understood you correctly, one of your main points was that information has a very limited effect on human's behavior. I'm not talking about Zoom collect, rumors, etc. At any rate, this is my opinion. Well, nowadays, it's not like in the Soviet Union. With the internet, even in the most authoritarian countries, people have access to all kinds of information. But there's so much access to care for their everyday life. So this is for them something very abstract. Some American presidents believe that democracy can be established in any country, if not today, then tomorrow morning. Yes. What one can expect for the countries that never experienced democracy during the century-old history. It's an abstract term to them, you see. I remember not only to the ordinary people, but only to the political elites. I remember in the first half of the 1990s, a delegation of some Kyrgyz ministers came to Minsk. And they discovered that they could talk in Russian to me, therefore they perceived me as one of their own, and one Kyrgyz minister asked me the question, whom and how much shall I pay in order that my son is admitted to university? When I told him, forget about it, nobody would like to go to jail. You don't trust me. You see, it's an abstract. You see, the people consciously, subconsciously believes that the matter participation is similar to them.
Yeah. Well, let me just very briefly comment on that. I mean, I think the claim I would make is that it's not that information doesn't matter, right? It's that in a context of information abundance, even overload, that an additional piece of information can be judged by, and is judged, right? At least that's what we see, that people can be discerning about how they treat different kinds of additional information. And that may be, so there's a trick here. I mean, you suggest that people don't care about new information. And I want to suggest that people are discerning.
They're very much influenced.
Sure. I mean, I think this is a hard thing to get at, because I want to claim that people are discerning rather than they, so if they choose not to be persuaded, it's because in a way they've considered it, not that they have simply dismissed it before it's even, you know, arrived in their brain, right? I think there's a slightly different philosophical, it has to be a philosophical kind of point, because we can't get into their heads. But ultimately, I think it comes down to the same thing. An additional bit of information in this kind of context can be, is unlikely to have a significant effect by itself. But repetitive messaging, loud messaging, the kinds of things that we could talk about even in the United States, right, do seem to cut through that kind of stuff.
One quick point, you may have done this already, you just didn't have time to show it. You've got to show heterogeneity of your results. In other words, for example, I don't know what you have for independent variables in your survey, but you'll certainly have age of the respondent, I assume.
Yep.
So age is going to mean a lot on some of these questions. I mean, it could potentially, certainly Nazarbayev, certainly the religion question.
Yeah.
Remember the people at Nazarbayev University, the students, they didn't live through any of the communist regime.
Right.
Their parents all did.
Right.
And that makes a huge difference in Kazakhstan. I assume it does in the other countries as well.
Yeah.
So even for that, there's a lot of ways you can model age. I mean, you can split the sample, but I don't think it's quite big enough. You'd probably be better to use either indicator variables or else continuous variables for age and see if there's some kind of way with an exponent you can put in there.
Yeah.
And there's other things, too, that you have as independents that check out that there may be heterogeneous results breaking out of those.
Right, yeah, like, absolutely. Yeah, next step. I mean, this is a first step. So
yeah, oh, yeah.
That's
sure.
That'll have to happen.
Okay, any other questions, comments? We're a little over our usual end time, so...